Okay. I do a seminar called Srila Prabhupada, The Living Bhagavatam. And what I've done is I've taken different topics like prasadam, chanting, cleanliness, etc. And I've taken all the different incidences and things Prabhupada said about those particular topics and put them into, you know, their own particular segments. And that way then you get a concentrated look at any particular aspect of devotional service, but directly from Srila Prabhupada or from incidences that he was involved with, etc. So I thought tonight we could talk about cleanliness, since that's an important devotional topic and one that I was always getting pulled up about when I was with Prabhupada. The time period that I'm mainly concerned with, of course, is when I was personally traveling with Prabhupada, and that means from about November 1975 through to March of 1977. If you just give me a second, I'll just pull this up. Here we go, cleanliness. Okay, problem with the file. Usually these segments take 2 or 3 hours, so we'll probably get about halfway or a third of the way through tonight, and then we'll decide tomorrow whether we continue on with the same one or we do a different one. There we go. Cleanliness. Good. Okay. Alright. Nivashandam ki jai. It's very nice actually to see everything, because I was here when the opening was. This is about a year and a half ago. And it's particularly nice to see Radha Giridhari and how well looked after they're obviously being. Nicely dressed, nice flowers, everything clean and neat. So it's very encouraging. Very nice. Okay, so we'll get straight into it then. So this is cleanliness. And of course cleanliness often involved prasadam topics as well. The two things go together. So as I mentioned, I joined Prabhupada's personal party in New Delhi in 1975, and just at the end of 75, November 26, I happened to be there in Delhi when Prabhupada came through. He was there a couple of days, and we also went to Kurukshetra, and then from there we went in early December to Vrindavan. So for me, it was the most significant period of my life, just, you know, getting the chance to personally serve Srila Prabhupada. It was something which most ordinary devotees, of which I was, still am, but it was something that none of us, you know, could ever even dream of, that we would, you know, personally be on Prabhupada's party and travel with him, especially by that time, because he had many thousands of disciples by the end of late 1975. And there were some established personal servants. And of course Prabhupada would always prefer to have with him people that were already trained in the service, because then he didn't have to, you know, go through every small thing again and again and again. But anyway, somehow or another, I happened to be in Delhi, and Prabhupada didn't have a servant at that time, and I was asked to take that up in increments, just the massage to begin with, and then some small things were added to that, and then after a couple of weeks then I was made a full-time servant. Actually, I remember one time in about October of 1975, I was the temple commander in Vrindavan, because that Vrindavan temple had just been opened a few months before in April at Ram Navami, and I had gotten there in late July, and they made me the temple commander 2 hours after I walked through the front gate. That was the way things were in those days. In India, you grabbed anybody that was available and put them in whatever slots there were, and there were a lot. So I was the temple commander. But there was one devotee who had been Prabhupada's servant. Prabhupada came at Janmashtami and stayed through Radhashtami. So it was about 2 or 3 weeks he was there. And he had brought with him, Upendra was on his party as his servant, Nittai was on his party, also doing personal service and Sanskrit editing. Brahmananda was the secretary, and Harikesh was also travelling with the party. So when Prabhupada left Vrindavan, he left behind Upendra, who was supposed to go to Fiji, and Nittai, who was supposed to join the Gurukul. So one morning, I remember at breakfast, speaking with Nittai about his personal service, massaging Srila Prabhupada. And I was telling him, you know, expressing my appreciation of that. And I was saying that it must be amazing to, you know, to massage Srila Prabhupada. I could never do something like that. You know, I couldn't imagine it. And I said, I could never do something like that. I'm just too gross, you know, to even touch Prabhupada. And he just laughed and he said, you'd do it if you had the chance. And I said, well, I'll never get the chance, will I? And then 2 months later, sure enough, that's exactly what I was doing. So maybe Vrindavan fulfills all your desires. Anyway, so when I joined Prabhupada's party, one of the very first things that I learned was that Prabhupada had a far higher standard of cleanliness than anything I'd ever experienced before. And there was an incident right on the very first night that taught me that. So this was around 9 p.m. on the evening of the 26th, and I had just given Prabhupada my first massage in the afternoon there. So Prabhupada had finished eating a little prasadam, and then he asked me to take his plate along with a basket of fruit that had been given to him earlier in the evening down to the temple. Could I get a glass of water? Is that possible? So in those days, the temple in Delhi was in a place called Bengali Markets, which is just not far from Connaught Place. And there was a small lane called Todamol Lane. And the temple was at number 19. But it was so small, Prabhupada couldn't stay there. And he was staying in a small flat just further down the road at number 19. So somebody had come in the evening at Darshan and given Prabhupada a basket of fruit. So Prabhupada had talked, and then he had his cook, who was Harikesh at that time, make him a little prasadam. Sometimes in the evenings he would have a paratha or a kachuri or something like that. So I came in at 9, and then Prabhupada had just finished eating. So he said, okay, take this plate, and there's this fruit here that can be taken and given to the deities. So, and I had to wash the plate off and then clean it. So I picked up the plate in one hand, and I picked up the fruit basket in the other, and started for the door. But Prabhupada immediately stopped me. He pointed out that the plate, having been eaten from, was dirty. I had picked it up, thus contaminating myself by touching it, and then I touched the fruit that was to be offered to the deity. He told me to wash my hands and take the item separately. So we all smiled at his thoughtfulness and my dullness. From my point of view as a disciple, both Guru and God are to be worshipped on the same level. So foremost in my mind was the thought that every little opportunity to render some service was for my own benefit. In other words, I thought that I was becoming purified simply by touching the plate that Srila Prabhupada had eaten from. However, he thought of himself as a humble servant of Krishna, and thus he saw the plate was now contaminated. And because he had such a high standard of purity, because the fruit was to be offered to the deity, he could not therefore accept the mixing of the two items, even though I had them in two different hands. But because I had something contaminated with one hand, you can't touch something that's not supposed to be contaminated with the other hand. Immediately you contaminate that as well. Prabhupada once said that Dirt is like electricity. So any contact with something mucha, immediately your whole body becomes contaminated. Then you have to wash. So in Prabhupada's presence, it's becoming quite clear how little I have learned in almost 4 years in the movement. Being with Prabhupada is opening up a whole new perspective on devotional service. As Prabhupada's assistant, one has to learn to see matters from his point of view, and that takes precedent over one's own. So there were a lot of things that I was starting to learn very rapidly. And one thing was that this seeing things from Prabhupada's angle of vision was absolutely necessary, because you were simply an extension of his service. So you had to act, you know, as one of Prabhupada's limbs, in a sense. So cleanliness was very, very important. And then again, 2 nights later, the same thing happened again. Prabhupada asked me to pour some water from a jug of water, and I got a dirty cup in my hand, and as soon as I picked up the jug, Prabhupada stopped me and said, "What is this? You're picking that up and you're already contaminated." So I had to put it down again and go and wash my hands again. So that was a couple of incidents. And the next day, on the 27th, after taking lunch, Prabhupada sat at ease in his sitting room for a short while. Then he walked through to the servants' room, to his bedroom, to retire for his afternoon nap. Hansaduta, Hari Kesh and I were in the servants' room taking our lunch. As Prabhupada came into our room, we stopped and offered our obeisances. I was sitting on the floor eating from a bowl with a spoon, and as I knelt back, I put the spoon down and I rested my hand on my knee. So I wasn't sitting, I was kneeling. And I just sat back, put my hands like that, and Prabhupada immediately stopped. And he said, "What is this?" He said, "You were eating, and then?" And then he started putting his hands on different parts of his body. Like a child contaminates his clothes whilst he's eating. So I blushed, but then my instinct was to say, "Well, Prabhupada, my hand isn't dirty, I'm eating with a spoon." But then I thought better of it. I didn't say anything, because I thought, well, Prabhupada can obviously see that I'm eating with a spoon, and he still thinks that I'm dirty. So then I realized that Prabhupada simply had a better understanding of what constitutes cleanliness. So Prabhupada laughed, and as he walked past us into his bedroom, he shook his head and said, "You're all brought up malachas." So then that evening, that was the water jug incident. I picked up the water jug again after handling Srila Prabhupada's plate, and he immediately noticed and corrected me. He laughed and he told me not to mind. He said, "This is the position of the guru, to find out the faults in the disciple and rectify him." That was something that he told me several times. Especially sometimes when he get angry and chastises, then he would stop and then he would laugh and he would say, "Don't mind." He said, "This is my duty. I have to chastise you." So it was simultaneously embarrassing and pleasurable to be on the receiving end of Prabhupada's reproof. His standard of purity is so much higher than ours. By his keen observation and objective criticism, he is training us to the highest levels, making us fit for serving Krishna. I felt very, very fortunate that Prabhupada is very patiently training us. Even though he sometimes calls us malachas, he's actually very proud of his Western disciples. He constantly points this out to his visitors, how we have been transformed into Vaishnavas. So these incidents have made me realize that Prabhupada also has unlimited patience in training his disciples. Although he must have given these same instructions hundreds of times during the last 10 years, he was still prepared to patiently teach the same things again and again to any new disciple, provided that that student has an attitude of humble service and is eager to learn. And that was another point that I learnt very quickly, was that inevitably, whilst I was with Prabhupada, I was going to make offences. It's simply not possible, you know, to not make offences when you're with somebody 24 hours a day. You're going to do something wrong. you're going to, you know, make some kind of mistakes, you're going to forget something, you're going to be inattentive, and it's just not possible to avoid that. So it was a kind of, in one sense, a quandary, that you want to serve your spiritual master, but at the same time you know you're going to make offenses. So what to do? So what I learned very quickly was that if you have the right attitude, then that will make up for the offensiveness of your actions. In other words, you make a mistake, but if you're humble about it and you accept that you've done the wrong thing, you take the instruction and then you work hard to avoid the same, making the same mistake again, then Prabhupada was always very, you know, amenable. But if you made the same mistake again and again, then he would get very annoyed with you. But your only defense, or your only protection against the reactions to those offenses, was to simply be very, very humble. And if you were humble, then immediately Prabhupada would forgive you. But if you weren't humble, then it was a whole other thing. So, that was late November. I just joined the party. Then about a month or so on from there, in early January, we went down to Madras. Tamal Krishna Maharaj came about 5:30 in the morning on January the 1st to be Prabhupada's secretary. And we flew straight down to Madras. We had 2 days there. And then we went by train on a 3-hour trip north to a place called Nellore, where we were supposed to be, or Prabhupada was supposed to be receiving some land, and he installed a foundation stone on this property that was being given to us. That was a whole other story in itself. But anyway, when we arrived at this place, then we very quickly discovered that the people that we were staying with, two sisters, the Katamanji sisters, they were actually meat eaters. And so as soon as we saw that, then Prabhupada told Harikesh, don't cook in their kitchen, don't use any of their pots. So I didn't even like going in the kitchen, but there was no salt. So when I went into the kitchen to get Prabhupada some salt, I saw that was just these big blocks of, you know, rock salt. It wasn't crushed or anything. So I needed a little bit of salt just for Prabhupada's breakfast, but I thought, I don't want to come into this kitchen too often, so I'll just spend half an hour and I'll smash up enough salt for the whole week. So I did that, ground it up, and put it in an open pot, and then I took it back into Prabhupada's room, and I put it on his chonki. Chonki's a little table just like this one. And I put it on the chonki so that when Prabhupada took his prasadam, he could just take whatever salt that he wanted, and then I'd leave the stock there. So, that's what my plan was. Anyway, during breakfast, Prabhupada began taking pieces of fruit and dipping it directly into the bowl of salt, rather than taking the salt from the bowl and putting it on his plate. Then when he finished, he went and he cleaned up and sat down, and then I came in and I started cleaning away his table. So he was talking with Yasodhanandan Swami about some preaching work. But as he was talking with him, I was over on the side and Prabhupada was watching me with one eye cleaning his chonki. So when I cleaned it up, I left the salt pot on the table. And then Prabhupada saw me starting to move away and immediately stopped. He stopped conversing. Immediately he rebuked me. He said, what is this? He said, you're simply a yavana. He said, this is your Western habit. He said, you eat something and then leave it like this. He said, there's no taste, there's no vitamin, and still you're eating. It means that we keep it there and keep it there and keep it there, or we put it in the fridge and then again take it out and eat it like this. He said, you have no, this is all malecha and yavana. So I was too embarrassed to say anything. But Harikesh knew what my intention was. So he told Prabhupada, he asked him if it would be all right if I keep the salt in the pot and then put some on the plate when Prabhupada takes his prasadam. So Prabhupada said, I do not know whether it is all right, but it is not all right that you eat and then keep it. this is not all right. So then Yasoda Nandan explained, well, he keeps the salt in a separate bowl. Then when you require it, he will only give you as much as you require. So then Prabhupada said, yes, that is nice. Well, I said, that's why the bowl is there. That's what I intended to do, but I have to keep it away from the table. So Prabhupada said that the principle should be that you should not leave remnants of food. As soon as it is used, it should not be used anymore. Otherwise, it is not possible to give up. It means give up your bad habits. Param drisva nivatate. I am eating something not very superior, but if I get the chance of something, eating something superior, then I give up the inferior. So that was another incident. And on, you know, leaving the remnants of food, later in the year we were in Bombay, and we had just come back from Prabhupada's last world tour. This was August 15th. And in the afternoon, Prabhupada, after having his lunch, then he would go and take rest for about an hour. And then when he got up, we would always have either some fresh fruit or some fruit juice and a garland and some sandalwood paste. And then we would offer that to him at about 4 o'clock in the afternoon before he had his darshan. So there were a lot of watermelons around. So I gave Prabhupada his fresh garland and sandalwood paste. And I gave him some watermelon. So the watermelons are so large that I only cut off one portion. And then I put the rest of it in the refrigerator to be used later on. Prabhupada happened to notice it when somebody opened the refrigerator, I think Palika. And immediately he said, what is this? He said, you cannot do this. He said, cut fruit must be distributed immediately. So again, you know, this habit of putting things in the fridge and then hauling them out later on, Prabhupada didn't like that at all. Then there was another incident later on, earlier, when I was in Mayapur. This is February of 1976. Tamal Krishna Maharaj was still on the party. And after Prabhupada had taken his lunch, he had gotten in the habit of going and sitting on the veranda of the Lotus building. In those days, the Lotus building was the only building in Mayapur apart from the front wall and the big kitchen. And that, you know, the temple was on the ground floor, and then there were some guest rooms up above, and Prabhupada's quarters are up there. So you could see all round Mayapur for many miles. Just flat land, rice fields, paddy like this, the Ganges, just in the distance there. So Prabhupada, after he ate, he liked to come out for about 10 or 15 minutes and sit in a chair and just look out over the balcony towards the Ganges. So I would come and I would sit with him, and Tamal Krishna Maharaj also would come, and we would sit, you know, on the ground there at Prabhupada's feet, and then sometimes he would chit-chat about various things, interesting things. One day he told us, he said, last night I had a dream about a planet where pious Mohammedans go. So then I was puzzled, and I said, well, is there actually such a place, Srila Prabhupada? I was also thinking, is there any such thing as a pious Mohammedan? But, because we'd heard, you know, they're all, you know, cow eaters and so many things. But anyway, I asked him, I said, is there actually such a place, Srila Prabhupada? And he said, oh yes. So he saw it in his dreams. Anyway, so what I was doing was I would bring a silver cup and have it there just in case Prabhupada wanted to have a drink. So on this particular occasion, February the 7th, Prabhupada was sitting there, and then he asked me for a drink of water. So in my eagerness, I reached out for his silver cup, but I moved too quickly, and I caught the top edge of the cup, outer edge, with the palm of my hand. So I almost knocked it over, but in the act of recovery, I kind of caught it like that with my fingers, but in the act of recovery, the tip of my finger went into the water, just the tip. So then I was immediately in a dilemma, because by this time I'd learnt something about Prabhupada's standards. So then I was in this dilemma, should I inconvenience Srila Prabhupada by throwing out that water and then making him wait whilst I went back down the other end of the veranda to his room and got some clean drinking water? Or should I immediately give him the water that's there, even though I've just poked my finger into it? So then I thought, I'd better just give him the water. So I took a guess. Wrong decision. Prabhupada sat there, he shook his head and he gave me a sour look. And then he laughed and he quoted from Bhagavad Gita, Pravittam cha, Nivrittam cha, Janana vidur asura. You are simply malecha. So in an attempt to rectify my bad habits, I've begun to take 3 baths daily, one upon rising, one just before massaging Prabhupada at noon, and the other one in the late afternoon. Still, it seems very difficult to know what a fitting standard of cleanliness is, although due to Prabhupada's association, I'm gradually learning. The other evening, I told Prabhupada that sometimes I wonder if I'll ever come up to the actual standards. Brahmanical cleanliness, I said, just doesn't seem to come naturally. I explained that at home, before becoming a devotee, I had been practiced to bathe not more than once a week. My mother still has that standard. I saw her last year. She said, no, I'll never bathe more than once a week. Friday night is bath night. So that was the way that we were trained. And what to speak about other habits. So Prabhupada assured me, he said, you'll learn gradually. But he also laughingly agreed that for a Westerner, it is somehow or another an artificial condition to be clean. So there were a few incidences there. Anybody have any comments up to this point? Or questions? Yes, Madhavi. So you're asking if the remnants includes that which has been left in the pots but not yet served out, and should that be eaten immediately or stored away? Well, Prabhupada would never eat it after it had been stored away, I can tell you that. Everything had to be fresh, and if it's not fresh, then it shouldn't be eaten. That's the standard. But it may be that, you know, to be practical and knowing our habits, Prabhupada may have given some instructions or an agreement at least that, yes, all right, you can save what's in the pots for later on. Maybe, you know, some cooks or pujaris can tell you about that, but I know what Prabhupada told me, and that was, you know, everything fresh, and then as soon as it's served, finished, that's it. And then you clean everything, and then, you know, when you eat again, then everything has to be fresh and wholesome. So now that's a few incidences mainly concerned with consumables, prasadam, salt, water, like this. A few other things to do with cleaning temples. So December 16th, 1976. Oh no, this is a different incident. This is a good one. This will come up in the next volume of my diary, in volume 6. I'm just working on this section right now. Kids and cleanliness don't mix. So this is December 16th. We were at the Hyderabad farm. That was a very big property, about 600 acres. It had just been donated to us. We'd actually occupied it for about a year, but the formalities, legal formalities, were just being completed in December, so Prabhupada agreed to go down there, and he spent 12 days with the intention of beginning a Varnashram project on that property. So traveling with us, there was Pradyumna, who was doing Prabhupada's Sanskrit work, and his wife, Arundhati, who was doing the transcribing work, whatever Prabhupada dictated in the night time from the Bhagavatam, then in the morning Arundhati would take the tape and immediately type it all out. She was very expert. And sometimes she was also cooking. So they were traveling with Prabhupada, and they had their 7-year-old son, Aniruddha, was also traveling with them. Prabhupada had given Pradyumna permission to take him out of the Los Angeles Gurukul when we were in America earlier in the year, because he was complaining that at 6 years old he still couldn't count from 1 to 10, and he didn't know, he couldn't chant any Sanskrit and things like this. So Prabhupada said, yes, take him out, as long as he trained him up himself. So he had no objection to homeschooling, as long as it was actually done. So anyway, Aniruddha was on the party. So wherever we traveled, there was the whole family coming with us. So this particular morning, I saw Aniruddha running across from one of the buildings to another. This was on a farm, and he had gotten a small puppy in his arms. He was very excited. He got this little dog and he was stroking it and cuddling it like this. So I yelled at him to put it, I didn't yell at him, but I shouted to him, put it down, you know, it's dirty, dogs are dirty. So anyway, off he went. Later on, at noontime, then he came into the kitchen in Prabhupada's house where his mother was preparing Prabhupada's lunch. Prabhupada had finished bathing and he sat down in his darshan room ready to take his meal. So as a special treat, Arundhati gave Prabhupada's plate to Aniruddha to carry into his room. I saw that Aniruddha was wearing the same clothes that he had on when he'd been carrying the dog. So I went into the kitchen and I told Arundhati off for allowing him into the kitchen and for handling Srila Prabhupada's plate, because it couldn't be guaranteed that he was clean. She was also giving him things to eat inside the kitchen. So an argument developed, with her getting very upset, bursting into tears, and angrily threatening that unless Aniruddha could come into the kitchen to be with her, then she wasn't going to cook anymore. So then that made me even more agitated that she could take her service to Srila Prabhupada so cheaply, as I was thinking. So Prabhupada was just in the next room on the other side of the door, and he heard all the commotion. So he called me in to find out what was going on. So I explained about Aniruddha and the dog and my objection and Arundhati's refusal to comply. Prabhupada came into the kitchen to see her. He asked Aniruddha if it was true that he had been carrying a dog, which he honestly admitted to. So then Arundhati told Srila Prabhupada, well, I made him wash his hands before handling the plate. So after hearing both sides, Prabhupada kindly explained to her that actually it was a fact that the boy should not come into the kitchen because he is young and it is not possible for him to remain clean. He told her, one should take bath before entering the kitchen, just as the deity room also. These two places are to be kept very, very clean. These rules must be observed. They are so that we can avoid seva aparad. So Arundhati calmed down and she accepted that. But still then she said Aniruddha had to be with her while she was cooking, because it took an hour and a half, and she said, I have to be able to see him. And he gets hungry around that time, but because I'm busy I can't tend to him. So it was a dilemma. So she still wanted to know if he could still come in while she was cooking. So then Prabhupada intelligently gave the solution. He said if it was not possible for them to be separated, Aniruddha can remain just outside the door on the back veranda. So he can sit at the door, he can look inside and see his mother, she can see him, so the two of them be happy. And then he said if he wants something to eat, then she can give him something and he can, you know, through the door, and he can eat it outside. So she was happy with that. And then he told her that attachment between mother and son is natural, but there is also the question of training. So she calmed down, accepting Prabhupada's advice as a good solution, and ended up smiling again. I was also happy to have Srila Prabhupada's backing on a strong stand that I had taken. So Prabhupada was able to satisfy all parties. Then going back into his room, Prabhupada called me in and added one extra piece of advice. He said that as a matter of etiquette, if I have some instruction to give to Arundhati, it should be done through her husband or himself, but I should not directly approach her. So Prabhupada kind of accepted that I was correct on the issue, but my methodology wasn't very tactful. So to avoid any further strife, then he said, you go to her husband or you go through me, but don't deal with it directly. So I learned one thing, a striking lesson from this event, how material attachment causes one to lose one's intelligence and good discrimination, and thereby puts one in a position where one commits offenses. Arundhati knew that it was wrong to allow her son into the kitchen, but because of her identifying, oh, this is my son, she insisted that he be allowed in, even to the point of threatening to give up her personal service to a spiritual master. But this is the power of Maya. So that was an interesting episode. So that was a few incidences. Because Prabhupada always said that cleanliness is the essential part of Brahminical culture. To be a Brahmin means to be clean. That's the first thing. And he used to point out sometimes that, of course, that was India's predominant culture, was Brahminical culture. Of course, nowadays it's finished, but there's still a few remnants. So one time, myself and Pushtakrishna Swami, he was Prabhupada's secretary, we were in Melbourne. This was on April the 22nd, 1976, and Prabhupada was relaxing on his asana in his room, and we were just having a chat with him whilst he was waiting for some guests. So Prabhupada was telling us that Western people have no understanding of proper cleanliness. He said, we do not bathe regularly, whereas in India the Brahmanas bathe not once, but three times daily, changing their cloth each time. Then he mildly reproached me again because of the numerous occasions he has had to correct my bad habits. He said that he is showing by his own example, washing his hands even after taking his medicine. But we are not learning. And I just saw a letter the other day that Prabhupada wrote. Somebody had recommended some devotees for initiation, second initiation. So Prabhupada wrote back a standard letter, you know, teach them the Brahminical principles, and let them hear the Gayatri Mantra. And he said, but make sure that they know the Brahminical standard. He said, even after giving Brahman initiation, I'm seeing that our devotees, that after eating, they do not wash their hands. They simply take some napkin and wipe them as if this is cleanliness. So he said, this is not Brahman, he said. So anyway, Prabhupada used to see these things. So I tried to reassure him that I am gradually learning. Prabhupada gave a wry half smile and shook his head. I do not know how long you will learn. He told us that in India the utensils used for cooking must be very, very clean. If a black portion remains, a Brahmana cook will not touch them. Even on the bottom, on the outside, Pushtakrishna asked. Yes, they'll not touch. Oh, it is still dirty. But in our temples it is going on, so what can be done? Prabhupada told us that our mentality considers it sufficient to rub dirty things with a little soap. But that is not cleanliness, he said. He told us about his mother's strict standards. If there is a black spot on the pot, he said, it will immediately be cleaned. My mother used to see every utensil, whether there is any spot. The maidservant had to surrender them for examination. When there is no spot, then it is finished. Otherwise, she has to do again. Everything should be neat and clean. The kitchen should be very neat and clean, washed twice daily, opened up nicely and smeared with water and gobar. And if you see that kitchen, immediately you will feel comfortable. So food is very cleanly prepared and then offered to the deity, and then you take. Automatically your mind becomes cleansed. So it's a science. If you prepare everything nicely, especially with food, we were just talking about this the other day, there's different components. Just like we have a gross body and we have a subtle body and we have a spiritual body. So food also has those components. There is the gross matter, there's the liquid portion, there's the subtle portion. And then if it's prasadam, it's a spiritual, it's completely spiritual. So if there's no prasadam, of course there's no spiritual aspect to it. But that subtle aspect of the food is infused into the food by the cook. So whatever the mentality of the cook is, if he's lusting over what he's cooking, that lust actually goes into the food, and then the person that eats it ingests that subtle portion of the food, and his mind immediately becomes lusty from eating that food. So this is confirmed here by Prabhupada, that if it's cleanly prepared, then when a person eats it, automatically, he said, your mind becomes cleansed. Science. So, another aspect of Indian culture and cleanliness. We were down in Hyderabad. This was in August of 76. Prabhupada went down there to open the Hyderabad temple. This was in the city. And on the 25th of August, Prabhupada accepted an invitation to visit the house of a leading Marwari businessman. Formerly, the Marwari community had not paid very much attention to us. But after Mahamsa had showed a leading member of their community some films on Prabhupada's work and on ISKCON, he had become so impressed that he had encouraged many others to contribute to our temple's construction. So when we arrived there, I was surprised to see that this wealthy man's house was quite dilapidated and practically unfurnished, save for a few old unvarnished wooden chairs and tables. Later on, Prabhupada explained that this is the reason why they're so successful at making money. They never spend it. We entered a large, almost empty room where they had a deity. Prabhupada sat down and gave a short speech. Then a local brahmana, along with a young boy, loudly chanted the Sri Ishapanishad slokas. They accompanied each intonation with various hand movements, and Prabhupada liked it very much. He had me record it, actually. So when we arrived back at the temple, Mahamsa told Prabhupada that the leader of the Marwaris had been in attendance at that program. He would most likely now give a substantial donation, which every other businessman would then have to match, because it was a matter of face. You know, once you get one from the leader, now he gives, you know, 25,000 or half a lakh, then you go to all the rest of them, and then, oh, he gave how much? Oh, 50,000. Oh, then I'll give 60. Like this, and it goes around because they all have to save face. So it was nice. So Mahamsa also commented on the rundown state of the house and the surrounding neighborhood. He said, these people are all craw patties. A craw is 10 million rupees. In those days, a million rupees, what was it, about 10 to the dollar? So, you know, it was a lot of money. That was $1 million, a craw. So he said, these people are all craw patties, and yet they're living in slums. So Prabhupada said that to live very gorgeously is not good. And he also pointed out that still the place was very clean. Their cooking pots were spotless, whereas in the house of a Parsi man that he had visited once in Bombay, he saw that the pots were all black underneath. He particularly said that because Mahamsa was from a Parsi family. So it was like the thing with me, you know, you're a Milecha and a Yavana. So Mahamsa was a Parsi. The Parsis are also Milechas, they're meat eaters. They live in Bombay, but they're originally from Persia, that community. So Prabhupada was telling him, well, I've seen in the house of a Parsi man in Bombay that all the pots are all black. But in this place, they were all spotless. So he said, nothing is cleansed, and for eating, they use this china, so that clean or unclean cannot be understood. Simply, it is washed. Then, talking about our own temples, he observed, when it is handled by this European or American devotee, the black, it is black down. So that should not be black. It must be cleansed. Not even that you can see any black spots, then it is clean. If there is a single black spot, then it is not clean. He said in his school days, even in the house of a sweeper, it was kept so clean that you would like to go and sit down there. The lowest class person, the toilet cleaners, would bathe two or three times a day, and all their utensils and living quarters were very clean. So this was Hindu culture, he said. Cleanliness is very essential, especially in the temple. If you are lazy, he said, then you cannot keep clean. oh, let me sleep for the time being. So that is the mode of ignorance, tamagun. So we have to conquer over rajagun and tamagun. Then there is a question of coming up to the platform of sudasattva. So again, Western standards of cleanliness, artificial. The following year, we were in Mayapur again, 1977, and I was sitting in Prabhupada's room. So he was speaking with Guru Kripa Swami about some managerial matters. Since it didn't concern me directly, I was kind of sitting at the back of the room and I was lounging a little bit and I wasn't paying attention. So as I was kind of sitting there, I just dipped my finger in my pocket. I used to wear one of those waistcoats, silk waistcoat. So I put my finger in the pocket and I found a toothpick. So I pulled the toothpick out and I was sitting there poking my teeth at the back of the room. And then again, Prabhupada was speaking with Guru Kripa, but he was watching me with his other eye. And then immediately he stopped. He said, "Why are you not paying attention?" He said, "This is not just for him, it is for you also. And what is this? You're always playing with your nose and fingers. This is your bad habit." He said, "Go and wash your hands." So I immediately had to go to the bathroom. And when I came back into Prabhupada's room, Guru Kripa had gone. I told Prabhupada that somehow, although I know what the standards of cleanliness are, it just doesn't come naturally. Prabhupada laughed and he agreed, yes, it's artificial. But he said, anyway, with practice, it will come. So, Prabhupada's personal standards. I mentioned that Tamal Krishna Maharaj had joined the party on the 1st of January, 76, for 1 month. And he had just flown in from America. We stayed for about 1 hour. And then we had to fly down to Madras. So we went straight back on the plane. Or he went straight back on a plane. And as we flew down, Srila Prabhupada took his breakfast on the plane. So we used to carry a tiffin box with us. And we'd, you know, put all the different items of prasadam in that box. And then we'd spread that out. I would sit next to Srila Prabhupada. We'd put the trays down. And then I spread it out and Prabhupada took his breakfast. So when we finished, Prabhupada had me pour some water into his glass. And then, first of all, he washed his fingertips by pouring water out of the glass. And then he drank the water. And then he was finished. So Tamal Krishna Maharaj was sitting opposite us and he was observing. And then he whispered in my ear, he said, "Just see how expert and cultured Srila Prabhupada is. He first of all, he washed his hands from the water from the cup, and then he drank. If he'd have drunk the water first, then he wouldn't have been able to wash his hands because it would have been contaminated." So it was a small thing, but, you know, he noticed that. Prabhupada was very, very cultured. And even when he drank water, Prabhupada was famous for, you know, holding the glass 2 or 3 inches above his mouth and just pouring it in so that his lips didn't touch the cup. And I also noticed that Prabhupada never ever licked his fingers when he was eating. Even though he ate with his fingers, he would take the prasadam and he would pop it into his mouth, but he would hardly touch his mouth at all with his hands. And what to speak about, you know, poking his fingers in his mouth and licking them, and which I know I do, but anyway. So that's a few things on prasadam. And other standards I saw. There was one thing that this was not something that I heard when I was with Prabhupada's party, but it was something that I heard in the early days in Australia, I think about 74 or so. Madhavisa told us, he had seen a letter. I don't know whether it was Madhavisa, but somebody had written a letter to Srila Prabhupada asking how many times a day, you know, do the different ashrams have to bathe? How many times for a householder? How many times for a brahmachari? And how many times for a sannyasi? So the reply was that a sannyasi should bathe 3 times a day. A householder should bathe 2x a day. And a brahmachari 1x a day. And I remember I was surprised when I heard that, because we were all thinking, oh, the sannyasis are the purest, so they should bathe less than anybody else. They don't need to bathe because they're pure, because it's back to front thinking. If you're pure, then you bathe more, obviously. And if you're not so pure, then you bathe less. Therefore, the brahmacharis only bathe once a day. We were visiting Mayapur in 76, and Prabhupada did an inspection of the Lotus building, and he went upstairs on the top floor. The brahmacharis were all staying in there. And as soon as he came up on the top, then he saw everything, you know, rags all over, kalpins hanging everywhere. Somebody had hammered a nail into the wall and then tied some wire around it and then strung it around the corner and around the other corner. So it kind of went around the end of the building, and the wire had cut into the building, and, you know. So as soon as Prabhupada saw that, and he looked in one of the rooms, he said, all of the brahmacharis must move out immediately onto the rooms on the front wall. He said, they cannot stay in this building. And then he said, brahmachari means it will be dirty. So Prabhupada knew very well what was going on. Everybody moved out straight away. Within an hour it was all empty and cleaned up. Anyway, so that's the standard. Sannyasis three times a day, householders twice a day, and brahmacharis once a day. And there's a few other things that I fished up about cleanliness. In general, just for the devotees. These are not particularly from my own experiences, but I got a couple of letters that I saw. There was one that Prabhupada wrote to Kanchabala in 1970, where he said that we shall touch the deity altar and the deity in a very clean condition after taking bath and washing the mouth very nicely. Practice washing hands after eating and wash with soap and water after toilet. Cleanliness is next to godliness. So this point should be very carefully observed, then you will advance very quickly to the perfectional stage. And there was another letter that I found to Madhavisa in 1975, December 75. Instruct the newly initiated Brahmins about cleanliness, taking bath three times daily, taking bath each time after passing stool. Cleanliness within and without, that is important for Brahminical life. And of course Prabhupada himself always bathed every day. When Prabhupada was in his younger days, I think he bathed several times a day, and he only ever bathed with cold water his whole life, even when he was living in Allahabad, because that's northern India and it's very cold in the wintertime, but he only ever bathed with cold water. But when he came to the West, then in 67 he had that heart attack and he was hospitalized in New York. And that was very serious, and then he ended up going back to India to try to recuperate. Once he got back to India, then he was told that now you have to bathe with warm water, because there's a risk, you know, the cold will be too much of a shock for your system. So from that time on, he started using warm water for bathing. And we would mix. We would give one bucket of hot water, and then he would mix it with some cold water to the right temperature and then bathe himself. He also started taking regular massages at that time, from 67 onwards, because of that heart condition. So Prabhupada's habit was that he would then bathe once a day, not early in the morning. After he'd finished his translation work at night time, then early in the morning, just after Mangalarati, then he would stop, and then he would go in and he would brush his teeth, he would go to the toilet, he would wash his face, and that would be it. Then he would come out, chant his Gayatri, put tilak on, and then we'd go out in the morning walk. And he used to take his full bath at noontime, or just after noon, after he'd had his full body massage. So we'd massage him with sandalwood oil on his head, mustard oil on the rest of his body, and then he would go in and then he would take his bath. So that was his regular practice, even when we were traveling. Sometimes if, you know, we were traveling during the period when he would normally have his bath, then he would adjust his schedule. So I noticed, you know, like when we had to travel, when we came from Bombay to Australia, we were going to be traveling for almost a full day. We actually ended up, we were traveling for 22 hours. And so Prabhupada called me in at 4 o'clock in the morning. We were leaving at 7. And he had his massage and his bath at 4 o'clock. And then he was ready to go. So Shrutakirti tells a story about when he was traveling with Prabhupada and they were going in transit through Thailand. So they went through the Bangkok airport. So this is from Srila Prabhupada Uvacha, Shrutakirti's little book. I don't think that's printed, but it's available in electronic form. So he says here that Prabhupada distributed his mercy without distinction. That was the kindness of the pure devotee. On a flight from India to the West, we had a 2-hour stopover at the Bangkok airport, and we had to wait in the transit area. Get my things, Prabhupada told me. I'm going to shower. So I went to the baggage area, opened up Prabhupada's bag, grabbed his lota, towel, and a fresh change of clothing. After a few minutes, I returned to his divine grace. Where is the bathroom? Prabhupada asked. So we walked together to the bathroom, but unfortunately there was no bathing facility. Srila Prabhupada was not easily discouraged. For him, there was never an obstacle. Assessing the situation, he turned to me and said, "All right, I will bathe from the sink." So he went in the men's toilets, stood next to the sink. So after putting on his gumsha, he poured water all over his body again and again from his lota. Then he washed himself with soap, and then he rinsed off again. I watched in amazement as he refreshed himself. He was transcendental to all the other activities going on around him. The attendant watched from a corner of the bathroom. He looked disturbed at seeing all the extra work that was being created for him, the water all over the floor. He had no idea that he was being benedicted by a paramahamsa. He was getting the opportunity to do pujari work by the causeless mercy of Srila Prabhupada. I gave Prabhupada a towel when he had finished. He dried himself and then dressed in a clean dhoti and a kurta. The attendant approached me as we were walking out of the bathroom. Although I had no idea what he was saying, I knew that he was complaining. Srila Prabhupada just laughed. "Srila Prabhupada," I said as we walked out, "I think that man's a little upset." Prabhupada laughed. He said, "Oh well," he said, "I had to take a bath. I was feeling very tired." So Prabhupada, at least every day, he would always have his bath, no matter what the circumstance. And I had a similar kind of experience, not exactly traveling like that, but during the Mayapur festival in 1976, a man had come to see Srila Prabhupada. His name was Prabhu Swarup Das, and he was the keeper of a small plot of land in a place called Haridaspur, which is about 2 hours drive from Mayapur and right on the border with Bangladesh. And he had this place, Sripat Bari of Haridas Thakur, and it was said to be the sitting place that Haridas Thakur had passed through that place for one day, and he had sat in that spot and he had chanted. And then when he left, the villagers had renamed the whole village Haridaspur just because he went through one day. And he was keeping this plot of land and he wanted to build a temple to commemorate that spot. So Prabhupada was immediately agreeable because Prabhupada actually had an idea about preaching in Bangladesh. So this place was right on the border and he thought that it would be very useful for us to have a temple there. We could come and go very easily. So he was, Prabhupada was invited by Prabhu Swarup to come to Haridaspur to inaugurate the project. So Prabhupada agreed, and we set out in the morning, and a lot of devotees also came out by bus. So the drive took 3 hours. So the man's ashram turned out to be a very small cottage situated on 6 bighas of land, which is about 2 acres, on the outskirts of the village with a small run-down shrine to Haridas Thakur. So Prabhupada spent 4 hours in a derelict single-room brick building. So it was just, you know, one room. That was it. That was the whole building. It was an earthen floor with weeds and grass growing out. There was only holes where the windows were supposed to be. There was a hole where the door was supposed to be, and there was no roof. It was, you see this in India a lot, like half-built buildings. They're just brick walls with holes in them and nothing else. So that's what it was. So this was where this man showed Srila Prabhupada. This was where he was to stay for the next 4 or 5 hours. So Prabhupada didn't say anything. He just moved right in. We put, you know, some gumsha down and chatter, and he sat down there. And then he said, all right, give me my massage. So I massaged him inside that place, and then he took his bath in the corner. We brought some buckets of water. He took his bath right there. And, you know, he was completely refreshed. Then afterwards, we took some prasadam. Prabhupada gave a little talk, and then we returned to Mayapur. So anyway, again, Prabhupada wasn't very easily discouraged. And again, later on April the 28th, we had flown from Melbourne here to Auckland. And that visit, we only were here for a day and a half. We'd been in Melbourne for a week, and then Prabhupada came through here. And in that day and a half, he installed God Nittai and Lord Jagannath. And he had an initiation ceremony also. Were you here for that, Carlos? Yes, I was the temple president at that time. Quite an interesting visit. There was a lot that happened in a day and a half. But because of the tight schedule, Prabhupada skipped his usual morning walk. He took a short massage at 5:30 a.m., followed by his bath. So we'd been there for a day, and then we were supposed to leave at midday on this 28th. But then Prabhupada had been asked by Srila Prabhupada, Yasamani Nandan, if he would install these deities. And initially Prabhupada had said no, because he didn't think that Yaso knew what he was doing. In fact, when they had the talk, and Yaso was trying to explain that we only have these very small Jagannath deities. They're about an inch and a half or 2 inches high. And every time that we had a kirtan, you know, it was a wooden floor, the deities would fall over. So they wanted to get bigger Jagannath deities. And back to Barry had carved these deities. And Yaso had actually made some altar for them, and also for Gornitai. So Prabhupada had arrived fairly late on the first night, and he had a darshan up until about 11:30 or 12 o'clock in his room. This was at Mount Eden. And then everybody went out. So Yaso stayed behind and asked Srila Prabhupada, you know, we would like to have Gornitai deities, and also we would like to have Lord Jagannath. And, you know, because the ones we have are too small, so we're going to throw those in the sea and put the big ones in. And Prabhupada asked him, why? Why do you want these deities? So Yaso had not been anticipating that Prabhupada would ask him, why do you want Gornitai deities? So he was a bit flummoxed. He didn't know what to say. So he said, well, you know, it's Lord Chaitanya's movement, and it would be nice to have Lord Chaitanya. And he was kind of tongue-tied a little bit. So Prabhupada sat back, he was a bit disgusted, and he said, just see, he thinks they are dolls. So Yaso wasn't sure then, at the end of the conversation, whether Prabhupada was going to install them or not. And he didn't know, you know, he really didn't know what to say to Prabhupada. So Prabhupada just left it hanging. Then the next day, when he greeted the deities, he saw Radha Giridhari was in the middle, and that there was, you know, two other altars on either side. And then he turned to Pushtakrishna and he said, they have for Gornitai and Jagannath? And he said, yes, they've already made the provisions. So then Prabhupada said, oh, okay, so then we'll install them. But it couldn't be done that particular day. It was too short notice. And Prabhupada was leaving the next day at midday. So that was the 28th. So then Prabhupada, because of the schedule, he got up and he had his bath at 5 o'clock in the morning, 5:30 in the morning, along with his massage. Then he came down, then he installed the deities, and then we left immediately afterwards for the airport. So, again, Prabhupada was always made sure he had his bath, whatever time. There was another, now some bathing pastimes of Prabhupada. When Prabhupada was just a new devotee, he used to go out sometimes to the Gaudiya Mat, the Chaitanya Mat in Mayapur, where Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, he has his house there, and that's the place where his samadhi is also. So in those days, Prabhupada said, sometime long ago, in the year 1933, in this Chaitanya Mat, so he said, I was taking bath. So he was down on the ground. We were talking, actually, there's this verse by Prahlad Maharaj that Prabhupada had given a class on, this Modeta Sadurapi Vrishchika Sarpahatya, that even a saintly person is pleased when he sees a snake or a scorpion is killed. So then he told us this story after the class in his room, that sometime in the year 1933, he said, there was one big snake that came out in front of me. I was taking bath. So everybody was looking what to do. So Guru Maharaj, he was on the upstairs. So Srila Bhaktisiddhanta, he had a two-story house, and there's a veranda there. So he used to come out, and he would walk up and down the veranda and chant his japa. So it just happened, Srila Prabhupada was there bathing in the yard, and this big snake came, and everybody, you know, was kind of didn't know what to do. And Srila Bhaktisiddhanta was up on the veranda, and he saw the snake. So then immediately, he ordered, he said, kill it. So then the brahmacharis came and the snake was killed. So Prabhupada said at that time, 1933, I was a newcomer. So I was thinking, oh, how is that? Guru Maharaj has ordered this snake to be killed. So I was a little surprised. But later on, when I saw this verse in the Bhagavatam, Madeta Sadurapi Vrishchika Sarpahatya, he said then, oh, I was very glad. It had remained a doubt how Guru Maharaj had ordered this snake to be killed. But when I read this verse, I was very much pleased that these creatures, or creatures like the snake, they should not be shown any mercy. So that was a bathing pastime, early bathing pastime of Prabhupada's. Then we had another pastime in Washington, D.C., on July the 4th, because that's American Independence Day, not that it has any connection, but we were there in Washington DC in 1976 for a week, and we had gone specifically for the Independence Day celebrations because it was America's bicentennial, 200 years of independence. So the devotees thought it would be nice if Prabhupada came to the capital, you know, for that celebration. So anyway, Prabhupada took his massage at noon, and then he went into his bathroom. So the setup was, there was like a bungalow that they had fixed up. They'd spent about $40,000 renovating this small bungalow for Srila Prabhupada. And you had to go through the bedroom and into the bathroom. And the bathroom was kind of sunken a little bit. So you went down a couple of steps. You opened the door, went down two or three steps, and then the bath was at the other end of the room. So I gave Prabhupada his massage. I escorted him to the bathroom door. Prabhupada went in, shut the door, and I started to go out. Just as I was going out of the bathroom, I heard this tremendous crash, you know, like glass breaking. So I had no idea what was going on. I rushed back. It came from the bathroom. I rushed back, opened up the door, and looked inside. Srila Prabhupada was standing in the bath at the opposite end of the room, looking very concerned and surprised. And then I looked down. In the gap between us, the entire floor was covered with thousands of shards of shattered glass. Then, shocked, I realized that I was looking at Srila Prabhupada through the now empty frame of the door of the shower. It was a glass door. The frame was still closed, but when Prabhupada closed the frame, closed the glass door, the whole sheet of glass just fell out and shattered on the floor. I was very happy that it didn't fall the other way, inside. It fell outside and then onto the floor. So anyway, then Prabhupada was very displeased and strongly criticized the shoddy workmanship. I fetched Brisha Kapi, who was the temple president at that time, and then we had it all cleaned up. So that was a little bathing pastime. Then another bathing pastime that we had, and this was really one of the best pastimes that we had with Srila Prabhupada in the whole time, at least when I was traveling with him. And that was the visit to Jagannath Puri on the 25th and 26th of January in 1977. Prabhupada had gone to Bhubaneswar, and he was going to stay there until Nityananda Prabhu's appearance day, which I think was about February the 2nd. And he had had Gaur-Govinda Maharaj fix up the place that he was staying in. There was no electricity up until about a week before we got there. Prabhupada told him, I'll only come there if you put the electricity on. So he had that done. And right after the Kumbh Mela, we went by train to Calcutta and then down to Bhubaneswar. So when we got there, we saw that this place in Bhubaneswar, it was some barren piece of land. There was nothing on it at all, except one small brick cottage. And that cottage was kind of, it had a dividing wall in the middle of it. So two rooms, very small rooms, maybe about 8 feet square. And a thatched roof, and that was it. And then for bathing, there was some hole in the ground outside, and he had put some kind of thatching up, you know, as a screen for Prabhupada to pass stool and then bathe. It was very, very simple, but Prabhupada loved it. Immediately he got on the, you know, in the thatched hut there, he was completely at home. So anyway, we were all thinking, this place is hopeless. You know, it's in the middle of nowhere. It was kind of just on the edge of Bhubaneswar. There was no buildings in sight. All the land around us was just like this dry, brown earth. And it really didn't look very, you know, appealing at all. So Gagamuni, he was there, and Bhavananda was there. And they suggested to Srila Prabhupada that, you know, we could get a nice place in Jagannath Puri. You know, why should we build something here in Bhubaneswar? You know, let's go to Puri and do something there. So anyway, they said that they knew where there was some land. And so Prabhupada agreed to visit and see these different plots of land. Although Prabhupada did tell us, he said that this Bhubaneswar land will become very important. And of course, if you go there now, there's this big temple that Gaur-Govinda Maharaj built. And the entire area is like a total, it's packed up for miles, all new buildings. And they were all constructed after we built our temple there. It's one of the most important areas of Bhubaneswar now. So Prabhupada obviously, you know, appreciated the importance of the place, although we couldn't. Anyway, to get back to the story. So on the 25th, we headed out to Jagannath Puri. We were only going to stay there the day and then come back in the evening. But whilst we were staying there, Gagamuni had rented a room in this place called the Tourist Bungalow Number 1, which was right on the seashore. And he got it's a two-story place, and he got a room on the second floor. And Prabhupada stayed there just, you know, have his massage and bath. And then Nanda Kumar was there at that time. He cooked for Srila Prabhupada. Sathroop was the secretary. And the whole Namhata team was there as well, Guru Kripa's men. They'd all come in from Japan. So in the afternoon, this man came, Sadashiva Rat. He was a pujari from the Jagannath temple. And he had heard that Prabhupada was in town, and he was kind of friendly with the devotees. So he came to see Srila Prabhupada. And I remember Prabhupada had him sit down and chant the Jagannath Stotram. All the prayers to Lord Jagannath. Jagannatha Swami, Nayanapata Gami, Bhavata. He chanted the whole lot from memory. And he had me record it. Prabhupada really liked it. And then the man asked Srila Prabhupada that tomorrow I'm having a pandal. And I have this book. It was somebody's commentary on the Bhagavatam in Arian. and he was going to inaugurate this book. So he asked Srila Prabhupada, will you come and be the chief guest and inaugurate the book? So then Prabhupada said, all right, yes, we'll do that. So then he told me, okay, now go back to Bhubaneswar and bring our things. So I had to spend the whole afternoon, you know, going back and then coming back again with all the stuff. And Prabhupada stayed overnight. So the next morning on the 26th, Prabhupada had his breakfast. And then early on, he actually took his massage. And he had an early lunch, that was it as well. So early on he had his massage. And then Prabhupada came out onto the balcony and he looked out over to the sea and he's kind of peering like this. And then he said, they say that bathing in the sea is very healthy. So I said, yes, Srila Prabhupada. So he said, what do you think? He said, should I bathe in the sea? So we immediately, me and Sathrup, we were, yeah, oh yes, yeah, that would be really nice. Be very good for your digestion and like that. So then Prabhupada left and he said, all right. He said, let us go. So he wrapped his towel around him and off we went. It's only like 50 meters practically down a concrete path and onto the beach. And when we got down onto the beach, then there were the Namhata boys. They were already in the sea, you know, body surfing. Which later on Prabhupada told him that he didn't like. That he said, you should go out and do some preaching. But anyway, they were there. He didn't complain at that moment. So we went down to the shore. And then Prabhupada dropped his towel on the sand and then stepped very carefully down to the water's edge. Because in Puri, they have, you know, sometimes the waves can be quite strong. And so Prabhupada came down to the water's edge. And all the members of the Namhata Traveling Sankirtan Party, they saw Srila Prabhupada coming down. Immediately all of them came around like bees around, you know, a honey pot. And Prabhupada was laughing. So he stepped down. There was Bhagavat Das was there. Jayadharma was there visiting from Sydney. And he had a camera. And he shot a whole roll of film of Prabhupada bathing in the sea there. So as the water came in and swirled around Prabhupada's lotus feet, it came almost up to his knees, and then it would swirl back out again, just around his ankles. So, you know, the sand was shifting a little bit, and it was quite strong. So I was holding Srila Prabhupada by his arm, just to keep him steady. And then Prabhupada, you know, when the sea came in, he would bend down and then start to scoop some water up, and start to rub the oil off his body from the massage. So then, as I was holding him with one hand, I also started to scoop water up and put it on his back and then on his head and wash him. So then, you know, Guru Kripa was there and a few others. They saw this is a chance. So Guru Kripa, his party, they started chanting the Brahma Samhita prayers. And it became like a whole Abhishek of Srila Prabhupada. So everybody came forward and then, you know, one after another, they started splashing water on Srila Prabhupada. And Prabhupada loved it. He was laughing like anything. You know, and he's standing there, and in the sand I was holding him and we were pouring water all over him. And I have to say, it wasn't much of a bath. I mean, as far as like getting the oil off or anything, it was completely useless. But as a pastime, it was wonderful. You know, just being there and bathing and splashing Srila Prabhupada with the seawater. And I know I was thinking about, you know, the stories of Lord Chaitanya bathing in the sea, probably in the same area of Jagannath Puri. So it was really, really nice. And then at one point, Prabhupada reached down, he scooped up some water, and he swilled his mouth out with it. So he kind of gulped the water. He didn't swallow it. But he swilled his mouth out and then spat it out. As soon as he spat it out, Guru Kripa's hand shot forward. He caught the water and he drank it. And Prabhupada saw that, he laughed. Guru Kripa was the only one that was quick enough. I didn't even think about it, but Guru Kripa was watching for his chance. So it was really good. So anyway, the whole thing took about 10 minutes. And then Prabhupada said, all right, that's fine. So then he came out and dried off with his towel, and then we went back into the hotel. So that was a very blissful pastime, bathing Srila Prabhupada. But that was the only time I got to bathe Prabhupada. When I was with Prabhupada, he was still, you know, he would have his massage and then he would go into the bathroom and bathe himself. When I was leaving Prabhupada's party in March of 77, we were in Mayapur, and just as the festival began, Prabhupada got very, very sick. And for about 6 days, he didn't eat anything, practically. I think the most that he ate was like one spoonful of prasadam. For 6 days, he had a high fever. He was laying sometimes even on the cotton gutties on the floor. And the whole system of serving Srila Prabhupada changed from that moment on. And practically speaking, Prabhupada didn't really go out and do any more preaching after that, because he had a visit to the Bombay Pandal, which was late in March, and he made that last trip to London for Janmashtami. But effectively, that was the end of his preaching leela at that Gaupurnima festival, and his body became so depleted from this illness that he just wasn't able to, you know, do the same things that he'd done before. So I was just leaving Prabhupada's party at that point. I'd been with him about a year and a half, not quite. And I was feeling the need for a break, because I started to feel that I was making offenses from becoming inattentive, you know, just from being there and everything being routine. And I was very, you know, afraid that I might make offenses if I, you know, continued on. So I asked Prabhupada if I could leave the party. My idea was that I would leave, you know, maybe for a month or something and just have a break, stay in India, and then come back again. But Prabhupada had other ideas, and he decided that I should come back to Australia, and he later on made me the GBC. But anyway, so that was it. On March the 13th, I gave Prabhupada my last massage, and then I left. And I had, before I could come back to Australia, I had to go to Delhi and get a new visa. Because in those days, I was a British citizen. I'd had residency, but I'd been out of the country for about a year. And I had to go and reapply for a residential permit. So I had to wait in Delhi for about 2 weeks to get approval for that. So all the devotees, they'd left Mayapur. They'd gone to Vrindavan for the Vrindavan leg of the Gaupurnima festival. Again, in those days, you know, going for Gaupurnima meant there was a week and a half in Mayapur and then usually a week and a half in Vrindavan. We would go to both places, and Srila Prabhupada would also travel to both places. So the festival was, it was then in those days, the Mayapur Vrindavan festival. Nowadays, practically, it's just Mayapur. And most people go to Vrindavan for Prabhupada's disappearance and Kartik. But anyway, so all the devotees had gone to Vrindavan, but Prabhupada stayed behind because he was too sick to travel. And I went to Delhi, and then I went to join the devotees in Vrindavan for a few days. Then all of a sudden I got a telegram from Tamal Krishna Maharaj saying Prabhupada's going to Bombay for the Pandal on the 22nd of March. So I was amazed, because I'd just announced the day before that Prabhupada wasn't going to go, and that he was going to go down to Kodai Canal, where there was this doctor and like a health resort place there. And this man, Dr. Sinagosh, he was a physiotherapist that had come, and he had massaged Srila Prabhupada for about a week in December of 76 when we were in Hyderabad. So this man had invited Prabhupada to come to Kodai Canal, where he had this health resort place, and try to help him to recover his strength. So that was the last thing I knew, and then all of a sudden we got this telegram that Prabhupada's going down to Bombay and he's going to go to the Pandal. So I was amazed. So I immediately flew down to Bombay, because I still hadn't got my visa and I was still kicking around. And I remember Yaso had just arrived from Australia and Ugrasrava, so we came down together. So then Prabhupada arrived. We picked him up in his car at the airport. The airport authorities allowed us to take Prabhupada's car right to the aircraft. And they wouldn't, myself and Giriraj, we were kind of standing, there was a fence, and you could see where the aircraft were. In those days, the airports weren't up to much. So there was no question of, you know, these big landing gates and walking, you know, through the tube right off the aeroplane and straight into the airport. You know, they brought the wheels, the ladders on wheels up to the door there, and you could see from the, you know, from the building, you could see the action there. So we watched, and everybody got off the plane, and there was no Srila Prabhupada. So I was wondering, what's going on? This is the flight that, you know, Tamal Krishna Maharaj just said they were coming on, and we didn't see him. Then we saw one of these trucks, the catering trucks, and they have these hydraulic backs. So the whole back of the truck, you know, the box bit, it goes up way up in the air and comes level with the aeroplane. And that's the things that they use for wheeling all the lunch trolleys in and out. So we saw this truck go out, it backs up, goes up, and then it comes down again. And then we saw Srila Prabhupada in a wheelchair. And they were lifting him down off the truck, and that's how they got him off the aeroplane. He couldn't come down the stairs. So they brought him down on, they brought this whole hydraulic thing out and brought him down on that. And then they allowed Prabhupada's car to go right up to the truck next to the aeroplane, and they put him straight into the car. So he came out through the gates, and me and Giriraj were standing at the gate, so Prabhupada stopped the car, and then he called us over and had us get in the car with him. So we jumped in, and then we drove to Hare Krishna land. And there was a whole other thing going on at that time in Australia, which I won't get into, it's a diversion. But some problems were there. So anyway, then we got into Prabhupada's new quarters. It was quite interesting because Prabhupada's quarters up until that point had been this small flat at the back of Hare Krishna land. When he purchased Hare Krishna land, there were six apartment buildings of two stories each scattered about the land. And they were all occupied by different tenants who had leases. So we couldn't get them off the land. So Prabhupada bought it anyway, and the devotees moved in. They were living in a tent to start with, and then Prabhupada hired a builder to come, and he built an extra floor on the top of each one of the blocks of flats, so they became three stories, and then everybody moved in on the tops of the other tenants. So Prabhupada had a little apartment on the top of this building at the back of Hare Krishna land. But by 77, because the Bombay temple was in full swing, the building of the new temple, Prabhupada was sending $70,000 a month from the American BBT to pay the contractors to build the Bombay temple. So it was really going up very quickly. And when Prabhupada came, he had been promised in January by Sarabi, who was the chief architect and, you know, overseeing the building, that his new quarters in the Twin Towers would be ready. There were the five-story guest towers, and Prabhupada's new quarters were going to be on the top of one of those towers. So when we arrived at Hare Krishna land, instead of the car stopping at the new, you know, hotel, it went to the back again to Prabhupada's old quarters. And Sarabi was there with the devotees, and Prabhupada sat there. They opened the door and Prabhupada wouldn't get out. And he said, why have you brought me here? And he was, so Sarabi was saying, well, Srila Prabhupada, your rooms are not quite ready yet. So, you know, if you can please, you know, go into your old quarters until we can finish them off. Prabhupada said, no. He flatly refused. He said, if I don't go in there now, he said, you will never finish. And he shut the door. He said, drive to the front. And we just drove off. Sarabi's running behind and all the devotees. And we came to the front of the hotel there, and then Prabhupada got out and he said, take me to my rooms. So I think maybe the elevator was working, Or maybe, I can't remember whether the elevator was working or not. But anyway, we put Prabhupada in a chair that we could carry him in. And then we got him up to the top floor. And when we came in, it was, you know, there was a half a dozen workmen in there. You know, plastering and banging with hammers. They were still, you know, putting in the doors and windows. And there was one guy there, he had one of these marble polishing machines. And the whole floor was covered in this, you know, horrible grey slurry from the polishing of the marble. So Prabhupada just walked straight in the middle of it. There was, you know, some scaffolding and stuff like that. And there was one small piece against the wall, which was a little bit clean. He said, put a chatter there. And we put the chatter on. Prabhupada sat right down in the middle of it all. And then Sarabi had to run around and get all the workers out and get all the tools out. And the devotees, you know, they, whenever we went to Bombay, it was nice because they would always have a Guru Puja for Prabhupada in his room. It was the only temple in India where this occurred. And so the devotees had to run from the other place with the aarti tray, and they came panting upstairs. And then we had this Guru Puja with Prabhupada sitting there on a chatter on the floor, and all this filth and muck everywhere, and, you know, the workers being pushed out the door. We had this Guru Puja. And so anyway, somehow or another, they kind of cleared the place out sufficiently. And out of his quarters, there was one room that was still ready, that was actually ready. They actually had doors on it and windows. So Prabhupada moved into that room. And then he said, okay, now we'll stay here for a few days. But then later on, because he relented, because the pandal was being held in the middle of Bombay, and it was like an hour or an hour and a half's drive through the traffic every day to get to the pandal. So what was decided was that after a couple of days, Prabhupada moved to Kartikeya Mahadevia's house. He was an early life member, very fond of Prabhupada, and he had a place on Marine Drive. So Prabhupada moved into that place because it was near the pandal. And then he told Sarabi, now when the pandal is finished, it must be ready. So they worked like crazy for about a week getting this place fixed up. And they managed to do it. They made a really nice job of it. Anyway, to get back to the bathing pastime there, I saw Srila Prabhupada when he first arrived. We talked. And then Bhavananda had come with Prabhupada as his servant. So he then, you know, gave Prabhupada his massage. And I was still talking with Prabhupada about these other problems whilst he was having his massage. Then at the end of it, then he took Prabhupada into the bathroom and he put a chair in there, and Prabhupada sat in the chair, and then he bathed Srila Prabhupada in the chair. So that was something completely new. I had never bathed Prabhupada before, and I have to admit that I was a little envious that Bhavananda was, you know, he just become Prabhupada's servant, and he was bathing Srila Prabhupada in his chair there. But that was because of his health. So he could no longer even, you know, bathe himself. He was so weak. And actually, when we got in the car at the airport, as soon as we got in, I was surprised. And then Prabhupada told me, he said, even up until this morning, there was no chance of my coming. He said, no chance of my coming. But he said, somehow or another, we are here. So, it was quite amazing. I mean, Prabhupada's determination, because they'd set this pandal up, he just, any way possible, he was going to attend that pandal, and he did it. But anyway, that was a new feature for the servants then, to have this opportunity to bathe Srila Prabhupada as part of their service. So, oh, it's 9:10 already. okay. Well, we were supposed to finish at 9:00. any questions or comments at this point? We've only done about a quarter of this seminar at this point. Does anybody have any comments at all? Or? Yes, Prabhu. Yeah. He's asking me for more details on the installation of Gornitai. What I can say is that I have this book called The Transcendental Diary. All of these pastimes are in these books. The particular pastime of Prabhupada's visit here is in Volume 2, which I think I saw. This book, it's right here. So that it's all in there, so I won't reiterate it, but this is Volume 5. I finally managed to get this one written and get it out after a seven-year gap from the last one. We got this out in March of this year at the festival. Madhuri Masaji bought a half a dozen copies. Have you sold out now? Yeah, how much were you selling them for? $20 for the softbound, and that's practically cost price. $30 for the hard. Okay. So if anybody wants to get a copy, this volume covers Prabhupada's visits to Aligarh, New Delhi, Chandigarh, and 5 weeks in Vrindavan. And there's a lot of really nectar and pastimes in here, a lot of nice instructions and things and incidents. So if anybody would like to get a copy of those, we have some hardbounds and some softbounds. And since Madhuri's already set the price there, $20 for the soft and $30 for the hardbound. Any other comments? Jai Srila Prabhu. That one's probably connected with the Aparad section. There was an incident where I accidentally locked Srila Prabhupada on the roof of his quarters in Vrindavan. I can laugh about it now, but I can tell you I wasn't laughing about it at that point. He was basically kept a prisoner, as he said, on the roof for about an hour and a half whilst I was downstairs talking, which was my favourite pastime. And anyway, that whole incident, that's in this new volume. Yes, bro. He's asking whether I took notes every day. Yes. Right from the first night that I was with Prabhupada, somewhere or another, Krishna gave me some intelligence to write things down. And because when I first joined the party, I was only supposed to be giving Prabhupada his massage for 2 days. And then somewhere or another that, you know, became a week and then 2 weeks, and then I was added to the party permanently. So I had started writing something down from the first night. And because I did that, then I thought I should keep, you know, I'll just keep on doing this. Initially, I was doing it just for myself. You know, I was just thinking, well, I'm going to get to massage Srila Prabhupada, and this is something that, you know, an opportunity you can't expect to get for lifetimes. So I thought, if I write this down, then 10, 20 years' time, I'll be able to read that and remember, you know, all the events. But then when I got added to the party on a more permanent basis, then I thought, well, I've started now, I may as well keep this up. So I did. There was only one period, I think, where I fell in a little bit of Maya and didn't keep notes for a few days, and that was in early November of 1976 when we were in Vrindavan. Although you'll see in this book, there is an entry for all of those days because I was still recording things. But I wasn't writing things down for about a few days. I skipped. But other than that, every day, yeah, I was writing something. And later on, after about 6 or 8 months on the party, then I actually started to think that this is a historical record. This is not just for me. But, you know, I should do this to preserve all the information about what Prabhupada's doing, who he's seeing, where he's going. Because at least in those days, we had no idea from 1 week to the next practically where Prabhupada was. You know, like in Australia, you'd hardly get any information from one month to the next. And maybe some little snippet would come, you know, or Prabhupada was just in New York, or... But you'd hardly hear anything at all about what he was doing, who he was seeing, you know, anything that was happening. And I realized, once I'd been on the party a while, I thought back and I thought, well, Shrutakirti was on Prabhupada's party for more than 2 years, and we don't know anything about that period. No, hardly anything. You know, and similarly with other servants. So I was keeping it fairly conscientiously, knowing that it was going to be a historical record. And then when it came to that day when I left the party in March of 77, it struck me very hard that I'm leaving today and there's nobody here to keep this up. So whatever happens now is not going to be recorded. So I, just before I left, I went into Tamal Krishna Maharaj's room. He had just been added as Prabhupada's personal secretary, permanent secretary, and relieved of his GBC duties so that he could do that. And I went in to see him and I said, Maharaj, you know, all the time that I was with Prabhupada, I was keeping a diary. So I have something practically for every day. And I said, now I'm leaving. So I said, I think, you know, you have to keep a diary and keep this up. So he said, oh no, you know, I'm too busy, there's so much to do, and like that. He wasn't really into it. So I insisted. I told him, I said, Maharaj, I said, you have to do this. I said, we don't know anything from, you know, Shrutakirti's time, or, you know, Nandakumar, or any of these other servants. So I said, you know, all this is going to be lost if you don't write it down. You have to do this. So he said, oh, well, you know, okay, I'll do something if I get the time. So that was March 13th. So if you look at TKG's diary, which is published now, you'll see that takes up sometime in April, mid to late April. So I think for about a month, because Prabhupada was ill and they, you know, then they went down to Bombay for the Pandal and these things, it was, Tamal Krishna Maharaj was very, very busy and couldn't do it. But in mid-April at some point, he started to think about it, and then he started to keep his diary. So we have, you know, for the last 2 years of Prabhupada's stay with us, we have a detailed account, daily account practically, with my diary and then Tamal Krishna Maharaj's diary. And I remember in 1978, we were in Vrindavan, and I was talking with Tamal Krishna Maharaj, and he asked me at one point, he said, what are you going to do with your diary? So I said, well, I'm going to write it up and publish it as a book, because I think, you know, all the devotees, they should know what I knew. You know, I've seen things now, I know things about Prabhupada that I didn't know, you know, previously, and I think all the devotees, all of his disciples, should have access to that information so that they can know Srila Prabhupada better, you know, in more intimately. So then I asked him, I said, what are you going to do with yours? He said, I'm not going to do anything with it. He said, I'm just going to keep it. So I said, well, you know, I really think you should publish it. So he said, well, I won't publish my, if I do, he said, I won't publish it until you've finished yours. So of course it took me many years to get round to doing mine. It wasn't till 86 when I first started to seriously think about doing some writing. By 89, I had done a rough first draft, and it was rough, I can tell you. And then I found an editor, and then I got married. Sitala, that's my wife, she's over there scratching her ear at the moment. She helped me with the editing, and she had a friend in London, Sita. She was a very good editor, so we got her onto it. We did a new draft of it, and the first volume I got out in 92. And then after that I got 3 more volumes out by 96. Then after that, for various reasons, I got distracted and I didn't do any more work. And then Tamal Krishna Maharaj, finally, he published his diary, I think in what, 98 or 99? Sometime around that time. So he finally published his diary. And of course we can be thankful that he did. because we weren't expecting him to leave us so soon, 2002. And if he hadn't got his diary out in 19, if he was waiting for me, we would never have seen his diary. So I'm very happy, at least, you know, somehow or another, he was, you know, pushed into publishing that. So I have now, as I say, this is volume 5. This goes up to the end of November. This is October, November of 76. The next volume I've just started work on will be December, January. And then there'll be one more volume after that, which will be February and March of 77, which is up until I leave the party there. And then I have one more diary that I kept in October of 77. Because I had booked in with Tamal Krishna Maharaj to be the visiting GBC secretary for the month of October. Prabhupada had a system. He would have one regular secretary, and then he actually wanted the GBCs, different GBCs to come, one, two or three every month, and spend 1 month with him and be trained up. So I booked in again, you know, for October. And I flew to Bombay at the end of September, last day of September, and Prabhupada had not long been back from his last trip to the West when he went to London. And when I saw him, I came in early in the morning and I saw him there in his quarters, and by that time his body was, you know, completely emaciated. He hadn't eaten anything solid, I think, for about a month at that point. And he literally couldn't move by himself. You know, he was simply lying on the bed all the time. So the same evening, Prabhupada called in all the senior men. There was about 8 or 9 of us. And he had us stand up in front of him, in front of his bed. And then one by one, he asked us whether he should stay in Bombay or go to Vrindavan. And of course, the Bombay temple was due to be opened at any time. There were almost finished with the construction, but there was a lot of finishing work to be done. So one by one we had to say whether we thought he should stay or go to Vrindavan. I had just arrived and I wasn't sure, you know, what the criteria was for making a decision like that. So when it was my turn, then I asked him, is it for health or is it for preaching? So Prabhupada said, it is for health. So then I said the same as everybody else, that I think you should go to Vrindavan. So all of us voted for Prabhupada to go back to Vrindavan except Gopal Krishna Maharaj, who was the GBC in Bombay, and he was anxious that if Prabhupada left Bombay, then the work would slow down and, you know, the opening would be delayed. And he wanted Prabhupada to be there for the opening. But anyway, that decision was made. And then the next day, either that night or early the next morning, Tamal Krishna Maharaj asked me to fly ahead to Delhi and then go to Vrindavan and prepare everything for Prabhupada's arrival, because we knew that, you know, we would need some extra things there to look after him. So I flew to Delhi. Bhagavatashraya Prabhu was the temple president at that time in Delhi. And I arrived, I went to see him, and I told him, we need a big bed for Srila Prabhupada that we're going to put in his darshan room, you know, and then once we got that set up, then he'll come from Bombay. So there was one man, Dawan. He was like a friend of the temple. He was a carpenter, or he had like a modern furniture store. Not a store exactly, but he was making, you know, modern furniture. So we went to see him and he had one bed. It was a big double bed. And he just had the one, so he sold that to us for 400 rupees. And we dispatched that immediately on a truck to Vrindavan with a mattress, double thickness mattress, and various other items of bedding and things. And as soon as that was done, then I rang up Tamal Krishna Maharaj and told him, okay, now we're ready, you can come. So that evening, then they all got on the train in Bombay. Sitala, she came, and about 40 devotees from Bombay Temple came with Srila Prabhupada to Vrindavan, and we went to pick Prabhupada up the next morning. from the Mathura railway station. So then that was it. That was, you know, the last visit for Prabhupada to Vrindavan. He was there 6 weeks before he finally performed his last pastime. So I was there for that month of October, and I kept another diary during that month, a separate diary. So that diary I may publish or not, I have to still decide. But if I do, it will be a separate edition from, this is called a Transcendental Diary, this is a series. But that one I'll probably publish as a separate entity of its own. But we'll see how that goes. I have to finish this one first. Krishna willing. So yes, I was keeping a diary every day. Any other questions or comments? It's 9:30. I think that we should finish at this point. And we'll continue tomorrow. We may continue with the pastimes of cleanliness, or we may do another topic. We'll see how it occurs. So thank you all very much for coming. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai.
I'm sure if anyone wants to purchase a book of Hari's story, he'll definitely sign it for you. Nothing like
yes.
This is a golden opportunity.